From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about plans to start resettling Afghan refugees in Wisconsin. Then we'll look at how communities like Cudahy are trying to attract younger residents.
The plan encourages some public improvements, things like bike lanes and outdoor plazas that tend to make urban areas more livable, more interesting, more attractive, both for new businesses as well as new residents.
Bubbler Talk finds out why inflatable reindeer have been seen at COVID-19 vaccination and testing sites. Plus, we'll learn about the signature wash fountain that launched the Bradley Corporation in Wisconsin.
It was a great idea, and shockingly, that same wash fountain with only just minor improvements is still sold today and is sold around the world.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with this. Some of the nearly 13,000 Afghan refugees at Wisconsin's Fort McCoy Army Base are starting to be resettled. The U.S. Department of Defense is providing transportation, temporary housing, medical screening, and general support for at least 50,000 Afghan evacuees nationwide. The Fort McCoy-based evacuees were briefed last week about what to expect, where they'll be going next, and who will be helping them. WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with Alexander Dertke, president and CEO of the International Institute of Wisconsin, a local organization that helps resettle refugees, about where things stand.
We're anticipating the arrival of Afghan refugees who will be coming into our community, and we are preparing to have them resettled. Now, I think, as you know, with the resettlement process, it is not something that happens all of a sudden and everything happens immediately. So once we get notification, I think the biggest challenge that we all have, no matter where they're being resettled at this point in time, is with regard to housing, because this is the major thing. They certainly have been in bases throughout the United States, but when they come here, say to Milwaukee or throughout Wisconsin, where are they going to be housed? That is the major thing. So I think when we have significant numbers of refugees, that becomes a real issue for us to deal with in terms of making sure that it is affordable and also safe housing. Those two things have to be accomplished.
And what factors into the decision on where to relocate refugees? Is it based on whether there are other refugee populations or other supports in place?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all of those things that you just mentioned in terms of the other supports that are in place. For example, in some places in Wisconsin, it'd be very difficult because of the whole public benefit kind of issue, and they're accessing a variety of different aids that would help them in successful resettlement. The other thing is, I think they also feel much more comfortable where there is a similar population or the population that they are part of. So some of that has to do with language, has to be customs, has to do with religion, etc. So we look at those places that are going to be, I don't want to say more accepting, but are have a welcoming kind of feeling for individuals who are coming out of a very traumatic kind of experience of being quickly uprooted from their homeland and put here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So like I always think about, you know, think of you're coming from a very warm place where you've never seen snow before. And all of a sudden, what you're going to do is you're going to be in snow and you're going to be in cold. And if looking at the weather forecast for next, it's going to be rather chilly.
And on that note, NPR reports that California is gearing up for the arrival of more than 5,000 refugees. Texas is getting more than 4,400, and Oklahoma will be taking in around 1,800. Any ideas about the numbers in Wisconsin? And
there have been a number of numbers that have been batted around, so I don't know what the final number is going to be in terms of the total number of refugees to be resettled. I think it is really going to depend on the services that are available for them. And the refugee resettlement agencies, of which, as you know, are now six in Wisconsin, spread out through the whole state, is what their capacity is going to be. I know here at the International Institute, we're anticipating at least 200 individuals that will be resettled. But I think on top of this, or below this, you have to understand, is that there are the normal flow of refugees that are coming from other places like the Congo, from Somalia, from Burma, et cetera. Those refugees are still coming in. And so this is in addition to those individuals.
And you touched on it a bit. You said housing is clearly the most important aspect of resettling. What about, and you mentioned the public benefits, what are some other supports and services that refugees are going to need?
Well, certainly they're going to need support in terms of volunteers, if I could put it this way, in terms of, for being example, mentors. You know, how do you learn about the supermarket that's here, or how do you get from point A to point B? So you're looking at that kind of volunteer capacity that you might have, or those services that you could do, as well as all those other important things that go into the resettlement. It's not only finding housing, but hey, we've got to furnish that house. How do we refurnish that? How do we supply bedding? How do we supply towels? Those kind of things that we just take for granted. Those individuals coming from, say, Fort Mackay, aren't carrying a whole bag full of bedding and pots and pans, et cetera, to their new home. So those are kind of the essentials that will be needed to assist them in that resettlement. The other thing is really is kind of gearing ourselves in terms of knowing, like, what kind of food do they eat? I don't know what food Afghani individuals are accustomed to. But if I give them Polish sausage and some sauerkraut, that might not go very well. So I have to look at those kind of things that are very important. This is where volunteers and other people who can assist us in that kind of customization, you might say, of the Milwaukee environment and helping make these people feel much more at home.
And I'd imagine there's also job search and finding schools and learning the language.
Correct. Those are essential points. And that's what I meant in terms of the more the benefit kinds of things, but those are equally as important, especially as we're looking towards moving this individual on or these families on to self-sufficiency. You have to go through all those steps as you move forward. And certainly that is in terms of employment, number one, also in terms of assessing what their capabilities were with language. You know, we might have a member of that family unit having been an interpreter, but their English might be around those kind of things that they had to interpret, not in terms of the generic language that you need to go through everyday life with that you will need as you move on. And then you're looking at schooling, medical benefits, those kind of things are equally as important.
And how do local organizations like the International Institute and Lutheran Social Services coordinate with the Department of Defense and more overarching support systems?
Well, generally, where we fit into is that we both have national agencies that we report directly to, okay? And that's the system that the refugees are resettled through, okay? Those other kinds of things we don't have much linkages with, if I could put it that way. So we're looking at local resources. And the next big level of resources is with state government in terms of the Bureau of Refugee Programs. And that's where we get additional support. And they help us with the coordination of the ongoing services that might be available for these individuals. They probably have more direct contact in terms of federal basis, but we're kind of a level below that federal kind of issue, and we're much more local. So local, welcoming, that's where we need to be.
And I guess a question that I didn't ask that I'm wondering about, like you talked about how different communities are chosen, but, you know, with California and Texas and Oklahoma, of all places, getting a lot of refugees, why would a place like Wisconsin not have as many?
Well, it could be weather. That's certainly one of them. But I also believe in terms of their having linkages with individuals that they worked with, not only the U.S. military, but also U.S. contractors abroad. And many of those individuals come from those places. So what you're looking at is, where is there a connection? You know, if I've had a relationship of working with XYZ person, okay, it might be in their best interest to be resettled in the community, that we already have some kind of knowledge of this individual. This person feels some trust of myself in terms of assisting them through the refugee resettlement process. So if you look at that, a lot of has to do around military bases, et cetera, that are very active. Whereas Fort McCoy isn't in that same kind of genre of training and individuals going overseas and serving abroad, et cetera, where some of these other places are. And so you're looking at those connections, and that's where individuals say, hey, I know somebody here. Or there might be the other hand, is that I have a family member or someone I know who lives within that community. Wisconsin hasn't been very high amongst Afghan refugees in the past.
Interesting. And how would people help if they're interested in helping?
Well, certainly we can use all the help we can get, no matter what agency we're from, whether or not Lutheran Social Services or the International Institute in the greater Milwaukee area. Certainly that is in terms of housing, if they know of housing that's available. And as I said, safe and affordable housing. We're not asking for free housing, but safe and affordable housing. Number two is in terms of financial assistance, because not all of this is covered by the U.S. government as they come in. So we do have to raise dollars in order to assist people for the necessities that they might have. Second would be is in terms of volunteering, of assisting in those kind of things, from ESL to mentorship to just being a buddy, you might say, to that. And then finally is in terms of when I talk about hard goods, if I could put it this way, there might be needs for furniture, those kind of things. You know, we see some clothing drives, but it is those other kinds of things. It could be from bedding to that, to sheets and pillowcases, to kitchen towels, to dishes, those kind of things. Those are also needed. So that's kind of the third level down. But it has to be something that we would like to accept. I think that's one way we can kind of gauge it. Is it something I would feel comfortable of receiving and using myself?
And one thing we didn't touch upon is, how is the pandemic impacting this whole undertaking?
Well, I think it has slowed down the process that we're normally used to in terms of our availability. And it makes us to be much more cautious and taking more time to get things moving. So there are many more parts, you might say, to the puzzle than we would have. Now, we're assured in terms of those individuals coming, because they have been in the various camps, they've been checked, et cetera, as to how they are doing. But I think at the same time, we also have to be aware that just because you have been vaccinated doesn't necessarily mean that you are not, cannot be infected. So you have to watch those protocols that you've set in place. Also, in terms of as they receive services, the services they are getting from other individuals, say, for example, volunteers, as we were talking about before, mentors, we have to make sure that they're in a healthy position, or that they step back and they get themselves quarantined, et cetera. So those all play part of it in terms of making it a little, I don't wanna say slower, you might say, is that we have to move a bit more cautiously as we move forward with all of this.
Al Dertka of the International Institute, best wishes with the resettlement process.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Alexander Dertka is the president and CEO of the International Institute of Wisconsin, an organization helping resettle refugees. He spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. Milwaukee was once known best for its many industrial pursuits. Breweries, canneries, and meatpacking plants have not only been a source of jobs, but were largely responsible for creating some cities and neighborhoods in the area. Bayview, West Dallas, and Cudahy are all named for the companies that created these communities. Now, many of these factories have lost their prominence, and these communities are redefining themselves as more than just company towns. Cudahy recently released a new master plan they hope could spur growth in the city and attract younger residents. Reporter Tom Dakin wrote about the plan for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins me now to talk about it. Tom, thank you, as always, for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
Right now, how would you characterize the city of Cudahy?
Well, Cudahy is an older suburb of Milwaukee. It dates back to the late 19th century. Its roots are in its name, reference to the old Cudahy packing plant. That was the reason why the city got started. And it still has the packing plant. It's now owned by Smithfield, I beg your pardon. But it's lost a fair amount of industry over the years to newer communities and newer business parks. And its population growth has basically ended. It's very stagnant, has a lot of older housing, and it's a landlocked community, unlike communities like Brookfield and Oak Creek and Menominee Falls. Cudahy can't keep expanding by taking the next farm field and turning it into a business park or into a residential subdivision or what have you. It has to make do with what it has. And that does present some challenges.
As we look at these challenges and the pretty extensive plan that they have for the city of Cudahy, how are they negotiating that?
Well, what they're doing is they're taking their downtown development plan and trying to implement that. It has some design guidelines in it that encourage more density. So perhaps instead of having new buildings built in and around downtown Cudahy that are two stories or even one story, you might get something that's four stories or five stories. Because, of course, when you can't build out, you build up. You go vertical, right? The plan also encourages some public improvements, things like bike lanes and outdoor plazas that tend to make urban areas more livable, more interesting, more attractive, both for new businesses as well as new residents. And then in addition to that, the city recently created a tax incremental financing district for that same area, what they call their gateway area, that again includes downtown and then stretches along, for those people who are familiar with Cudahy, stretches along Layton, basically from Lake Drive all the way out to, roughly Pennsylvania Avenue. And that TIF district would help pay for commercial projects in that area. So in other words, let's say you get a new light industrial building, which is actually in the works for that area. With the new property tax revenue generated by that building, you can use that to help finance that development or help finance some public improvements, perhaps a new street, a new sewer, to make that investment happen. And then one of the final things the city has done is it recently changed its ordinance to allow restaurants and bars to use street parking lanes for outdoor seating. And that's something we've seen in a lot of other communities in our area, Milwaukee being an obvious example, but in communities like West Dallas, Wauwatosa, Shorewood, that have also taken that step. And these are all kind of tactics that wrap into a larger strategy that Cudahy is using as it sees apartments, really nice apartments, and other major commercial developments being built in some of the neighboring communities on Milwaukee's South Shore.
As you say, it does seem like this is in part a response to what's happening in other communities around them. It also seems to be that they're trying to attract younger home buyers, people who, you know, might continue the legacy of the city of Cudahy. Has that been working in these nearby neighborhoods?
Well, in St. Francis, for example, you've seen hundreds of new high-end apartments added on the lakefront. Now, has that translated into new homes being purchased in St. Francis so far? I don't think there's been a huge increase in home ownership in St. Francis, but if you think it through logically, if you build hundreds of apartments, those are nicer apartments, you're attracting people who have, you know, the income levels that make it doable for them to become homeowners. If they live in St. Francis on the lake for a couple years and they grow accustomed to that community and they like it, it's logical to think they might buy a home in St. Francis. In South Milwaukee, there are plans in the works for apartments right in downtown Milwaukee. Now, that would be a mix of both market rate and affordable apartments, the latter being restricted to people who earn no higher than 60% of the area median income. But 60% of the area median income, that's really not, I don't think, anyone's definition of poor or low income. And people who can earn up to that level of income, again, can become homebuyers if they have affordable choices. And one advantage Cudahy has going for it, which I believe it shares with South Milwaukee and St. Francis, is affordability for housing. You yourself are a recent home buyer, so you've been down this road and you know what it's like trying to buy a home for the first time. And it's not easy right now. There is a real lack of starter homes in the Milwaukee metro area, as there are in most other metro areas throughout the United States. And these are communities, including Cudahy, that perhaps provide that opportunity for young first-time home buyers.
Sure. Would you describe the homes in Cudahy in general as being starter homes?
I mean, I think there are quite a few that would meet that definition. Again, it's an older community that has an older housing stock. I mean, I think about the first home that my wife and I bought. That was an older home built in the 1920s. And the advantage for people who are starting out is homes that were built in the 20s and in the 30s were smaller than homes being built today. So you're not going to have as much space as frequently you'd find with new construction. And perhaps you're not going to find some of those amenities that are common today that weren't common in the 20s and 30s. But it's a way for you to get your foot in the door, to get your first home, and to start building wealth with that property, perhaps before eventually moving up to a little bit bigger house as your family grows or as your income increases and, you know, gives you that ability to buy a bigger house.
Now, as we're looking at the city of Cudahy, and they're pretty grand plans, do we have a timeline?
No, and I should make it real clear here, when communities like Cudahy do these sort of wide-ranging development plans, it's still dependent on the private sector to be attracted to the community, to view it as a good place to invest money and build an apartment building or a light industrial building or an office building or what have you. That still has to happen, obviously. But by developing these plans, you're laying the groundwork for that to happen. You're essentially telling the private sector, look, we're serious about trying to attract you to our community. We've created a TIF district. So if it is warranted, I repeat, if it is warranted, we will do a TIF district to help make that happen. We are creating design guidelines, so you can be assured that if you build an apartment building here with four or five stories that encourages density, we're not going to allow a one-story flat to be built next door within our downtown area because it's not an appropriate use. We are going to create the public infrastructure, such as the bike lanes, the public plazas, to make our community more livable. These are all, from my perspective, these are all necessary things for any community to do if it hopes to attract private investment.
All right, well, we'll see what the future holds. But Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Joy, a pleasure as always.
Tom Dakin covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's a regular Lake Effect contributor. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the wash fountain that launched the Bradley Corporation here in Wisconsin 100 years ago. But first, we'll look at how sociologists are studying how behavior has changed because of the pandemic. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Sociology is the study of society, social behavior, and the culture of everyday life, all of which have been majorly impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. It's changed the way we interact with other people, how we work, and even how we get our food. There's also new social norms, like mask wearing. So, how are sociologists observing and processing these changes? Harry Perlstad is a sociology professor emeritus at Michigan State University, and he's researched healthcare and healthcare programs. He spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver in June about the sociological approach to looking at this pandemic.
There's two ways of looking at it. One is that the sociological perspective would be similar to sociological studies of disasters, a hurricane or a flood or something, or an earthquake, where we've found out that generally people come together after these kind of events, and neighbors help each other clear their places and rebuild their lives a bit. And so that's one way of looking at it. So I think that's probably the best analogy that we have currently. There are studies of epidemics and so on, but most of those are historical.
And what are some of those historical lessons from previous plagues or pandemics?
Well, the most famous is by Thucydides of the Great Plague of Athens in 430 to 427 BCE, where they basically locked themselves inside the walls in the city. I think it was cholera or some communicable disease. But Thucydides writes that the people were willing to do things which they would not previously have admitted to enjoying. So they thought it reasonable to concentrate on immediate profit and pleasure. No fear of the gods or laws of men had any restraining power, since it was judged to make no difference whether one was pious or not, since both could be seen dying. And so in terms of COVID, we can find the COVID equivalents today of the lack of fear of gods or laws in the United States. That's been brought about by the disruption of everyday work, schooling, recreation, and pleasure events, and religious activities. And so we've seen an increase in violent crime, aggravated assaults, and homicides in 2020 that have continued on into this year. This includes mass shootings, as well as guns used to settle disputes over road rage and wearing masks in supermarkets and things like that, unfortunately. There's also been, as many of you know, increase in scams involving identity theft, fake charities, stimulus checks. If you only send us your information, we can put it in your bank, tax refunds, and so on. And there's an increase in participation of social and political movements, most notably the mass street protests following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And actually in Athens, about a year after, within a generation of the plagues, that's when life in Athens really bloomed, and Socrates and the plays were written and things like that. So it was a rebuilding of the culture right afterwards. But basically, in our equivalent is the rise of partisan and political movements.
So hold on, can you parse out a little bit what you mean that it made no difference that someone was pious or not? You know, the plague was affecting everybody the same. How do you see that in modern day, like in the United States during the COVID pandemic?
Okay, Thucydides basically noted that people were doing things that they ordinarily wouldn't do, and they had no fear of the consequences, either of the gods, if they believed in the Greek gods, or in the laws. And so I think what we've seen in the United States is a relaxing of fear of police or civil constraints on what people do. And so I think that's led to an increase in the gun violence that we've seen, the mass shootings, the shootings of people having arguments over masks in supermarkets and places like that, because people just feel free to do whatever they want and they don't fear the consequences.
Do you feel like people are having negative emotions and negative stressors because of the situation, having their, you know, livelihoods being taken away, having their outlets being taken away, having their access to sometimes good health care? Do you think those things are causing stress and anxiety in people, and it's more that and less like, oh, we're free to do whatever we want because COVID is killing people indiscriminately?
Well, I think that people have their anxieties about their health, about their health care, about being laid off from work, not being able to pay their rent, and so on. And that then the question is, how do they relieve these anxieties? And so sometimes, you know, some people can go to a food bank, or their neighbors will help them get groceries and things like that. But there's some things that your friends and neighbors can't do, like take care of your health insurance or pay your rent or things like that. And so then people get anxious and they say, well, what can we do? And some people just say, well, there's nothing we can do. We might as well just strike out or lash out of whoever in every way we can to relieve this tension.
And those are definitely some of the downsides and difficulties of the pandemic for society. One of the other things is we've seen social inequities growing during the pandemic. Underserved communities tend to be more affected as frontline workers. They tend not to have as good of health insurance. They're more at risk for evictions. There's the lack of technology for remote school or work. So these economic fault lines were sort of exacerbated. Is this something that you've seen in pandemics of the past?
So the last pandemic as we had was in 1918, 1919, with the great influenza pandemic. That was relatively short. I don't know of anything that happened, like whether radio was disrupted or things like that, which would be the equivalent of losing internet or losing other sorts of things. So this is really sort of a unique or first time where, since we're such a high technology society, and it's difficult to know what's going on. On the other hand, during the Depression in the 1930s, banks foreclosed very quickly. People lost their housing and things like that. And I think we've had a better handle on trying to get people, not being evicted from their houses when they're not able to pay this, encouraging landlords and tenants to work out agreements on how they can pay, partly of this. So I think we've improved since, say, the 1930s on how to handle the economic crisis when people lose their jobs, things like that.
Do you know how people in the past, any idea how they dealt with disruptions in work and school and socializing? Like, there was no Amazon delivery services or curbside restaurant pickups, those kinds of things. Any ideas? Have you looked into that at all?
Well, the most famous one is Sir Isaac Newton, when one of the plagues came through England, and he stayed home for a year and thought up all his famous theories and had a year off from studies and was very, very good. The way people lived earlier was that a lot more people lived on farms or had agricultural gardens and things like that. And so they were able to take care of food. So I don't think it was quite as widespread in the cities as it is today. And then the rural areas, I think, were much more self-sufficient in the Middle Ages and in the pre-industrial revolution times than the rural areas are today.
What are some ways that sociologists can look at this pandemic, this COVID-19? What are some of the ways that they can study it and try to address some of the inequities and improve society?
The essence of sociology is to compare things. We like to compare individuals, opinions on the environment, on their families, on politics, on religion, and things like that. And so on one level, we do a lot of surveys comparing people's values and views on these various topics. We also look at the way organizations and groups interact with each other, which groups are trying to push for social change, which groups are trying to maintain the status quo. And so there are some studies that can be done on that level too. And then there's also the United States being a federalist republic, as we've seen, governors and states can react to the pandemic in quite different ways. They can close it down, they can open it up. New York and Massachusetts did one thing, South Dakota did quite another and really didn't have any mandates at all. So you can compare what different states have been doing and then within states, what different counties or municipalities are doing too. So there's a large range of things to look at, and we can see, okay, how many of them had increases or decreases in cases before or after the mask mandates or after the mandates were lifted. So those are other kinds of things we can do studies of.
Harry Perlstad is a sociology professor emeritus at Michigan State University. He spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver in June about how society has changed in response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Marty Michelson. For this week's Bubbler Talk, our listener Connor Bowman asked us,
what's the story with the reindeer I've been seeing at COVID testing and vaccination sites around Milwaukee?
What Bowman is talking about are these giant inflatable reindeer that have been placed at various locations run by the Milwaukee Health Department. You can see them while waiting in line to be tested or vaccinated. Bowman says he first saw the reindeer last December at the drive-up testing site near what was then known as Miller Park. The reindeer were present again a few months later when he was vaccinated at the convention center in downtown Milwaukee. Bowman says the reindeer had a soothing effect on him.
When I saw them around the holidays, it was a lot of comfort. And then when I saw them around like February and March, I was comforted. But then I was like, what? Why are they here again? Like, I just thought it was a very funny and chaotic kind of appearance that they were back at the Wisconsin Center.
The idea behind the reindeer is to provide solace and inject a bit of humor into a stressful situation, according to Nick Tomorrow of the Milwaukee Health Department. I met him at the Southside Health Center testing and vaccination site, where a giant reindeer sits on a tall platform near the ceiling. Tomorrow says the concept came to him late last year when he was shopping at Home Depot for supplies to stock the testing site at the former Miller Park. He says he spotted the reindeer in the holiday section of the store for those who like to display giant decorations on their lawns. Tomorrow thought the reindeer would help lighten the mood as the city was facing a surge in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations at the time.
You would just see the general public come through the testing site in big numbers. And, you know, you think about morale. And so we were walking through Home Depot and, you know, one of these steers was blown up and it's just kind of a funny thing. So, and it was on sale. So, yeah, I thought, well, we're going to get some reindeer for Miller Park.
Tomorrow says he purchased two of the deer and displayed them at Miller Park for the duration of the holiday season. Then the health department started rotating them at different sites, from the stadium to the central vaccination site set up at the Wisconsin Center earlier this year. Tomorrow says even though reindeer are typically associated with the December holidays, the city placed one at the Deer District vaccination site this past summer during the Milwaukee Bucks playoff run. He says the reindeer served as a quirky public relations tool, both for the Bucks and for vaccines.
And what I loved is the announcer at the Deer District, when we were out there for vaccine, was using the deer as a landmark when we were out there. So they said, go to the big inflatable deer to get your vaccine. So,
currently, the reindeer are making the rounds at several sites in Milwaukee, including the Southside Health Center and the Northwest Health Center, plus a new location in the Menominee Valley. Tomorrow says you might see the reindeer at some other venues in the near future as well. He says the city is in talks with Milwaukee Public Schools to set up vaccination clinics for kids and place reindeer at those locations. Marty Michelson, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union and Palermo's Pizza. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk is a regular series here on Lake Effect, and you can hear it every Monday at noon and 8 o'clock. At WUWM.com, you can find our previous episodes of Bubbler Talk, including why Thiensville is landlocked by Mequon and the story behind two brick pillars on Milwaukee's east side. Coming up, we'll learn about a Wisconsin company that was founded with a signature wash fountain. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Hygiene and hand washing have been more important than ever during the pandemic, but you might not think too much about what you actually use to wash your hands. The Bradley Corporation was founded 100 years ago in Milwaukee on the idea to help people wash better. Today, they make a multitude of bathroom equipment, but it all started with their iconic circular wash fountain,
that allows multiple people to wash their hands at the same time. To learn more about the company's history and how hygiene innovation has been impacted by the pandemic, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with John Domasi, the Director of Global Strategy and Corporate Development at the Bradley Corporation.
Harry Bradley, who was one of the owners of Allen Bradley, who was always inventing things, realized that his employees on the shop floor were taking so much time of their lunch breaks standing in lines to wash their hands. And he felt really bad that those employees were taking, you know, 10 minutes of their 30-minute break just waiting to wash their hands. So he said there had to be a better way. So he solved that problem by making a circular wash fountain that allowed multiple employees on the shop floor to wash their hands at the same time. And not only did that save time and the employees loved it, but it also saved water, saved space. And he saw, wow, I made a better mousetrap. You know, so how it actually came to be more than just a great idea at a single company was that other company leaders who would tour Allen Bradley, they'd like Allen Bradley's normal products, but they go, wow, where did you get that wash fountain in the middle of your shop floor there? That's incredible. And they wanted to purchase those as well. And he said, well, we don't sell those. I just, you know, made those prototypes to help my own employees. Well, one by one, the word got out about the wash fountains, and two local investors, one of them being by the name of Howard A. Mullett, said, well, if you're not going to sell these yourself, we would love to really make a company of this because we're just so, you know, fascinated by this. We think this has a lot of legs to it, you know, to go. So they purchased the patent from Harry Bradley, and out of respect for him, named the company Bradley Wash Fountain Company. And that was back in 1921. So it was a great idea. And shockingly, that same wash fountain with only just minor modernization improvements is still sold today and is sold around the world.
I had one of those wash fountains at my grade school and middle school. And, you know, when I was a kid, it like made going to the bathroom so much fun because you could hit the foot pedal and, you know, it was like this big group activity you could do. And I, of course, had no idea it was a Wisconsin product, of course, but reading up on the history here, it just makes it all a bit more special with that connection. And as you mentioned, this company was founded on the concept of making hand washing a smoother process and taking out those points of contact. And now, of course, in our world of dealing with a pandemic and life post-pandemic down the road, do you think these kinds of designs will just be more standard and widely incorporated due to just how much we have thought about hygiene in recent history?
Very much so. What has happened, and this certainly didn't happen just because of COVID, but in the past 20, 30 years, Bradley has really been looked at as an industry expert in commercial hand washing, commercial bathrooms. For the last 10 years or so, we've been doing a proprietary study with 1,000 users of public bathrooms each year. So we're an industry expert in how people use it, what their expectations are, the cleanliness expectations. And obviously, like you said, from COVID, obviously all of that expanded dramatically in a very short amount of time. So touchless sinks, touchless faucets, touchless soap dispensers, things like that have been growing every year, you know, long before COVID. But now the impact of COVID is going to be like how 9/11 was on airport travel. COVID is going to be for commercial building design. And it is permanently going to impact commercial building design and especially commercial washrooms in all those buildings.
So of course you mentioned no-touch fixtures. What other changes are here to stay?
Well, there's in our survey, we do get input on this. It isn't just no-touch fixtures. It's better ways of entering bathrooms. Sure, like at airports, you've seen that they're doorless and they have something called a corridor concept, where you have kind of like an S pattern that you go into. A lot more companies are considering that. A lot of companies are looking at touch-free flushers. The more that you can make everything no touch, the better it's going to be. There's a lot more considerations now for foot entry and exits on doors. I'm sure you've seen some of those where you can just pull a little latch on the bottom of the door and kind of, you know, just pull it open with your foot. A lot more of those things are going to happen. And the specifications right now that are going through architects and engineers are dramatic.
On that note, is there a rise in antimicrobial materials, whether that be for stall handles or even surfaces of sinks?
Yes, there is an increase in antimicrobial materials themselves, antimicrobial properties, even if it isn't fully antimicrobial. And the most important is just easy to clean surfaces. Prior to COVID, especially in higher end hotels, restaurants, resorts, even some office buildings, you'd see very ornate, rough surfaced type of decks and sink systems and things like that, because aesthetically it was very appealing. Those are not easy to clean. And there is definitely going to be a dramatic change in that, because the speed of cleaning, the ability to truly fully clean a surface, is so much more important today than it was in 2019, that you are going to see material experts continue to come out with very aesthetically pleasing materials, but all of them will need to have some type of easy to clean capabilities, and probably the ability to withstand a lot more cleansers and materials and things like that without bleaching their surfaces. So antimicrobial will continue to increase, as well as easy to clean designs.
Now, Bradley was established right here in Milwaukee, and it's now based in Menominee Falls and also has a plant in Germantown, so very much has stayed here in Wisconsin. But one other thing that stands out in your company history is Elizabeth Wetherell, the first female president of a Wisconsin company. Can you share more about her and her legacy?
Yes, Elizabeth Wetherell actually started as a administrative person in Bradley when I believe there was only 20 people total in the whole company. And quite a story. She just very hardworking, very intelligent, very dedicated. And through different war times and things like that, she continued to rise to the occasion, was counted on for more and more responsibility. And in 1942, which was obviously right in the middle of that real trying time in the United States, Elizabeth Wetherell was promoted as the president of Bradley, and she didn't know it at the time, but she was going to be the very first female president of any Wisconsin company at that time. So she really paved the road for a lot of people in Wisconsin. She was it was amazing. We went through all the archives, you know, with it being the 100th anniversary, and there's not a lot of pictures. She wasn't one to have big presentations and things like that in front of all the employees. She was definitely someone who led from behind, a very quiet, humble leader, but one that was very effective and got the company through a very rough time in our country's history.
As the company celebrates 100 years, how do you think remaining in Wisconsin has been a strength?
The Mullet family, we're in our fifth generation of ownership now. They have been just unrelenting in their commitment to the Milwaukee area, to Wisconsin, and made in the USA. We certainly get a very small percentage of our products overseas and, you know, other areas outside of the Midwest. But any opportunity that we have to source materials in the Midwest, source materials in the United States, continue to build our labor force in the Wisconsin area, that has always been a very important priority for the Mullet family. And We have very dedicated employees. I've been at Bradley 25 years. I am by no means even close to so many people that have been at Bradley for 30, 40, 45, 50 years at Bradley. And I think it's that commitment and dedication that the ownership family has that really resonates with the employees, and that's going to continue for generations to come.
John Domasi is the Director of Global Strategy and Corporate Development at the Bradley Corporation based here in Wisconsin. He spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in April, and you can see photos of the first wash fountain at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about a proposal to start a sandhill crane hunting season in Wisconsin. Plus, our October Dig In with Venus Williams looks at how to put your garden to bed. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.